come here to help me launch my book, Kosher Movies, a Film Critic Discovers Life Lessons at the Cinema. Aaron Rukefet is one of the Rosh Yeshiva at YU, been there for many, many years, has also taught my children as well as myself, and I'm happy he's here to leave the holy confines of Yerushalayim to come to Beit Shemesh to share his words of wisdom. So let me call on Rabbi Rukefet.
Recorder's working? Okay. I'm humbled to be here. I already met students long before I knew Herb Cohn. There's some other students sitting here, and you're absolutely right. BMT changed the course of Torah history in the Anglo world. And I'm Modeh LaKadosh Baruch Hu that here I am, the only survivor of the original faculty of BMT when it began in 69. And the Watsons will testify that just this past Monday, I gave shiur in the Kollel. It was the final shiur for the semester. I'm standing here before you because of a gentleman whose name was Sempo Sugihara, Zeichet Tzadik Lefracha. I was a kid in the Bronx. Herb and I grew up not far from each other. He grew up in Mount Vernon, do I have it correct? And I grew up in the Bronx, and we always considered Mount Vernon an extension of the Bronx. But I was more fortunate than Herb because after 1 year in public school, and I write about it, and I'm also an author of a number of books. In my seventh book, I write the whole story. You can see it there if you're interested. It's a book with a very simple name, Washington. I have another volume coming out now, and if 10 people understand it, I'll be very proud. It's heavyweight lumbers. It's going to press next week. But I was more fortunate because after 1 year in public school, the teacher advised my mother, your kid is too smart to learn here, one-third Jewish, one-third Italian, one-third Irish. Send him to a parochial school where he'll have a double curriculum. And to my mazel, Yeshiva Rabbeinu Israel Salanta was five little blocks from my house, the yeshiva that began in Harlem 100 years ago, basically, moved to the Bronx, Washington Avenue, then moved to Webster Avenue. Those of you that own Bronxites know what I'm talking about. And I came to Salanta, and I had teachers, Oisvaps, Trumpenicks, Lo Yitzlach, these were people, maskilim, who didn't make it in America, try to do business. Oh, they went back to teaching something they learned in their youth. They were not inspiring figures. And then in seventh grade, we suddenly had a new genre of teachers, Shanghai crowd, alive because of Sempo Sugihara. And these teachers didn't speak a word of English, I didn't speak a word of Yiddish, but somehow our hearts met. In eighth grade, I had the Rebbe who was to have the greatest influence on me and enabled me to go further in life, Rav Henoch Fishman, who was part of the Shanghai crowd, Zeichet Tzadik Lavracha, Talmud of Mir, Talmud of Rav Yeruchim Levavitz, the Mir Mashkiach. And he lived in the Bronx, not far from us. I became friendly with the family, with his son Heshi, Zeichet Tzadik Lavracha. And we sort of interacted and integrated. And Rav Henoch taught us a great deal, just more than just the Gemara. We learned Wie zu sein ein Mensch, how to be a decent, upright human being. And one time he let his hair down, I think it was a Friday night, and we were a group of fellows in his house, and he mentions, I'm living it in Yiddish, which became my native Torah language afterwards, but I'll say it in English, unless everyone understands Yiddish. Who doesn't understand Yiddish? I forget it. All right. By the way, the Yiddish, you should know, came in. It was a gift from God because it enabled me to be a Talmud of the Rav in the full sense of the word. And when I worked for the Mossad in communist Russia, outside of Leningrad and Moscow, let's say in the smaller cities, Minsk, Riga, Vilna, any Jew above the age of 40, his native language was Yiddish, and I was able to communicate not in English, not in Hebrew, but in Mamelush and in Yiddish. So Rav Henech was letting his hair down, and he said to us, and again, the young generation doesn't understand this, in America, what Saturday night meant, everyone went to the movies, there was no television yet, there was certainly no computer, and the women went to the hairdressers on Shabbos, 10 o'clock appointment, 11 o'clock appointment, everyone had to look good, big, beautiful theaters, the place, the Concourse Plaza, they had these glorious names, and hundreds of people would come and see the movie. So one time Rav Henech told us, he and his wife decided, what is America all about? They were greenhorns. They wanted to understand what America is about. So they went to see a movie. They went to see a movie, and he says, "Ken fashtein min tutachet. I understand you do a sin, you do it privately. But to do it on a movie screen that millions of people are going to watch, he couldn't understand it." Evidently, a boy and a girl kissed or whatever. I mean, today what goes on movie screens make what Rav Henech was upset about look like child's play. So we listened and it was an interesting discussion. So he never went to movies afterwards. He did allow Heshi to go with me to a Yankee game, and I came home from the stadium with Heshi, and I said to Rav Henech, "Hein tabich gemacht ein Sohn an Amerikaner. Today I turned your son into an American. I took him to see the Red Sox versus the Yankees, Yankee Stadium, which was a 20-minute walk away from our homes." So right away this raises a question, going to movies, wasting time. Women are very fortunate, as my wife always says, you men have to say shalom isani yisha, you're always in a respect whether you're learning enough, whether you've accomplished, I have certain goals I have to do, I'm going to shas nachamol, baruch Hashem. And women, baruch Hashem, they're not obligated, so they can have yisha time if they wish. What about men? But I learned something else from Rav Henech Fishman. And in my own research, of course, I come across it, I would say, daily. Besides Shas and Paiskim, I have a Yetzer Hara for Jewish history, which I have a doctorate in, and I've published a little bit in it. So I'm working in it right now again. So, in Europe, who was home during the summer? A volume came out here, a doctorate was done on the yeshiva and the interbellum period between World War I and World War II. And the yeshiva had tremendous expenses, but among the expenses, students had to go to the dacha, had to go away. We would call it the bungalows, call it a camp. It was part of the yeshiva curriculum, 3 weeks a year between Tisha B'Av and Chodesh Elul. You have to rest up, you have to regain your strength. So you see, even in Reb Henech's time, there was a concept of leisure time. In contemporary times, there are already Divrei Torah articles written, you'll see in Tchumim, dealing with this whole concept, how do we work in leisure, to recuperate, regain our strength, etc. All right, I need not tell you that one of the prime forms of leisure time are movies. And my dear colleague, friend, Talmud, father of Talmidim of mine, Musmachei HaYeshiva, and Herbie is basically a Talmud of Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein. I would say he's a Talmud Mufak. He not only has smicha, but he has a PhD in English literature. All right, I'm not a Talmud. I'm a Talmud in learning of the Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik, but he had a PhD in philosophy, and my students will testify. When it comes to philosophy, I don't get excited, but I have a doctorate in a Jewish Torah history. That excites me. So you go to movies. What can we learn from movies? Of course, I'm talking about decent movies. Halavai, we should have more and more. And I want to speak about a few movies that Herb writes about that I have seen. I've seen some of them more than once, and there's so much we can learn from them. For those of you that are on Chinuch, I would require every Rebbe, and by the way, the Haredi world would gain immensely if they saw and understood a movie called The Dead Poets Society. And you can read the details in Herb's magnificent volume, which integrates movies and his own life. And he has not had an easy life, and he deserves all the credit in the world to him and Merrill, who have overcome adversary, the kavod ule tiferet. And you talk about the Dead Poets Society. First of all, it shows you what a charismatic teacher can achieve. There's a teacher there, John Lee Keating is the name in the movie. It's played by an actor called Robin Williams. I'm not fully aware of who Robin Williams is. I did come in Aliyah almost a half century ago, and we've had some other problems on our minds during the last 50 years. But it's a fabulous movie. It reminds me of my very first teacher in Yeshiva College. And here, let me give you a drop of background, and you'll understand both the Dead Poets Society and my first teacher. I was learning in Lakewood, and I was the happiest kid in the world, Libi Chashka B'Torah. I had one desire, to be a Gaon, to be a Tzaddik, to be a Chassid, to be a Melamed. I never became a Gaon, a Tzaddik, or a Chassid, but thank God I did become a Melamed. And I was learning in Lakewood, and I loved Reb Aaron Cutler. I was a bright kid. Reb Aaron, it was a mutual love society between us. And I have many stories I can tell you about my relationship with Reb Aaron and the Alta Mashkiach, Reb Nassim Wachtvogel, and I wanted to remain in Lakewood. My mother was hysterical. She had gone to college. My parents are American born. And what, you're going to learn, and you're not going to have a panasa, and you're not going to go to college. So my parents were putting the screws on me, particularly my mother. And where I grew up, fathers had no say in the family. A father's job was to go to work. His mother's job was to have supper ready for him when he came home. And he would then read the paper and relax. But the mothers raised the family. It's the world I grew up in. Today, it's already feminism. It's a little bit of a different world. And I have to deal with it daily, with the questions and the vicissitudes of contemporary life. But that's the world where I grew up. All my friends are fathers. Nothing to do with forging the children. The mothers, aim kol chai. So my mother, so I made a deal with my mother. You know what, Mom, I'll try Yeshiva College for 1 year. If I don't like it, I can go back to Lakewood, absolutely. All right, September 1955, I'm registering Yeshiva College, and Professor Alexander Brody is still teaching. I sign up. I have a choice of mathematics or history of civilization. For whatever the reasons, mathematics, I would never dream. I have endless grandchildren getting degrees in mathematics here, conquering the Technion, etc. What's mathematics? Was geht mir an in Leben with mathematics? History of civilization. And then we come to class the first day, and we are told Professor Brody is being semi-retired, and there's a young kid coming in to teach, Louis Feldman, and a graduate of Harvard, taught in Trinity, Louis Feldman. And I was in his very, very first class. And just like the Dead Poets Society, he looked exactly, had the same build like John Keating in the movie. John Keating stands on the desk. What do you see from here? Trying to show the students how life can be different, seeing it sitting, standing on the desk. Louis Feldman, I envision him. I don't know if he ever did it, but it wouldn't surprise me if Louis Feldman stood on the desk. What a teacher. We walked into class, and here I'm out of Lakewood, and he gives out the syllabus, and the first lecture is going to be, does science support the Torah? I was buying a bus ticket back to Lakewood. I was so upset. Who is this Apikiris? He's going to talk about science. And he got up and gave a lecture that I have used that lecture 1,000 times over subsequently to tens of thousands of students. Moshe met the Torah, with the Gilgamesh epic and the flood, with the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach and the Hammurabi Code, what he was able to show how every tradition is valid. And he would say, and we of us who believe in Torah, we don't need any proofs. But certainly proofs will not hurt. And boy, with that lecture, I became a devoted disciple of Torah Umata. So you see how far a teacher can have influence. That's one part of the movie. There's another part of the movie that is critical. And we struggle with this today in the greater Torah world. There is no cookie cutting form. When we make cookies, so you can go into any store and you buy this shape, that shape. I have grandchildren, great grandchildren today left dinosaurs. Get a little dinosaur. You can cut out 100 little dinosaurs and bake them for the kids. When it comes to chinuch, every person is different. The greatest mistake we can make is to force children to be exactly like us, to follow in our mold. That is totally against what chinuch is all about. Two volumes have just appeared on the swing to the right in American Orthodoxy. You know, I'm out of America long before the swing to the right. Two students once accosted me about 10 years ago in the Kollel. Rebbe, why did you leave America? Had you remained, why you would be so much more open and blah, blah. I said, idiots, had I remained in America, I'd be like everyone else. But two volumes just appeared. One by professor, my student, Rabbi Dr. Adam Furziger of Bar-Ilan University. And I walked into Grist this morning, a new book was waiting for me that came out in America. I couldn't believe it. JPS, a documentary history of modern Orthodoxy in the United States. And they're both dealing with the same problem. What does it mean to swing to the right? The Rav was offended. The Rav couldn't tolerate it. Read my second volume on the Rav, Mori Rebbe, the Rav, the world of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. I quote Rebbe word by word. Everyone dresses the same. Everyone is black suit, white shirt, black hat. That is the antithesis of what Torah stands for, what chinuch is all about. We have to be open. We have to give a youngster commitment to Dvar Hashem. We have to teach him there's a framework. That is halacha. It's like a picture. The frame has to be solid. The frame cannot be cracked. The frame cannot be curved. Halacha commands obedience, but picture you paint is your picture. And I'll tell you, I have a grandson who we finished the Hesder and Akotel. He told his Rebbe he was going to Bezalel. That Rebbe gave him Musa, going to Bezalel, who knows what will happen to you there. All right, I'd only go further. He's third year Bezalel. He's won every award under the sun. He's a genius in art. This is his ability. And this is a kid who wears a kippah that's bigger than mine. He just had to do a movie on a person who's creative. So he chose his grandfather. He chose his grandfather. Fine, he took pictures of me, interviewed me. So I hear this is going to play in Bezalel. I spent most of the interview talking about my madrich and Bnei Akiva, Meir Kahana. and I have to tell you, he just got an award in Bezalel for the interview with his grandfather on Meir Kahana. Okay, it's powerful. I have an article coming out on May in the next Jewish Action, and I'll be speaking in Lawrence this summer on Meir, on his 25th yard site. So when you look at the poets, the dead poet society, the greatest mistake is that father and teacher forcing the kid not to be unique, not to be different, not to express himself. Ultimately, he commits suicide. Okay? And I have a story in Washington, a true story, which in many different contexts I utilize it, but I'll use it here and end off on the Dead Poets Society. Very simple story. Some of you know that as a result of Malka and myself, our involvement with Russia, the Mossad. So when we came back from our first trip to Russia, we founded a Russian outreach society, yeshiva center called Shvut Ami. Shvut Ami exists until today, and as a matter of fact, I have new plans and new ideas, and I have a student that, I have a number of students this year of Russian origins. I'm trying to do something very big with the kids. We don't need him for the Ukraine, we have other people, but for the Russian kids who are Native Americans already and reach out to them and bring them to Yiddishkeit and Torah and the State of Israel. So you talk about the Russian society and what you saw there and how communism attempted to take every individual and destroy his individuality. And it's the exact opposite. This is why America, with all its faults, democracy is infinitely, infinitely better. It allows the individual to express himself. All right, so that's one movie. It's the plot, the movie, the acting. It's a classic movie. I want to take another movie, The Visitor, which is a very fascinating movie. And I don't know if you know, Herb has introduced me to a drum circle. And I have a Talmud here. Vic, where are you? Do I see you? There you are. Vic Snow is a drummer who was professional, paid his way through college and graduate school, hitting away at the weddings and bar mitzvahs and the yeshiva dinners in the greater New York area. And it's a very fascinating movie, The Visitor. Briefly, what catches our attention is here we have a college professor involved in the nitty-gritty of the field that he was in, and he burns out. And tragedy hits him. Thank you. His wife dies. And he evidently had a good marriage. We never see her. We never meet her. And he's teaching in Connecticut, and he comes back to New York, and in his New York apartment that he hadn't been in months, a young couple is living there, illegal immigrants to the United States. And it shows you this man's ability to be reborn, to shift gears, to change lifestyle. And he gets involved with this young couple and learns from them. One of the men is a musician, and the drum and the scene of how this professor ultimately gets involved in a drum circle, and like he's reborn and he finds solace after his wife's death. It's like a new life is beginning for him. And I want to tell you, this is crucially important. Reb Shmuel Belkin, Dr. Belkin, maybe some of you recognize the name, the second president of Yeshiva University. So Dr. Belkin always used to have a vort, Keino hatnishta mashkanta after Kaddish Baruch Hu. To translate it simply, no one owns God. Ribbono Shel Olam can do what he wants. We pray, we hope for the best, but life can throw us a lot of curveballs. And the ability to rebuild after you've been moved sideways, you need strength. And not all of us can handle it. This movie, The Visitor, is beautiful in showing this old-fashioned, staid professor shifting gears and becoming a new person. On a personal level, as a Rebbe, this too is crucially important. You're looking at an individual who's no youngster anymore. And as I mentioned, I just, this Monday past, finished my 57th year in the classroom. Did you bring in the Kiddush at the end? Who? I don't know, that was Jay Solomon's. We thank him for me. I never had that before, that they brought in the keyboard. We ended off. You know, we have two levels in the class. The official students who are getting supplementary rabbinic credit for sitting in and hearing Rakefetz Narishkeit. And beyond that, we have the outsiders who add the world to the class. I need not tell you, some of the outsiders are world famous in their fields, as you probably understand. So, you see, with the Rebbe, I saw this in YU. When YU, the tragic moment in September 1960, when Danny Greer got the Rav to switch from Yiddish to English, that was the end of Torah in America. At that moment, you knew, I'm quoting the Gemara in Baba Kama, you knew there would be Churban Habayit and the students. I'm a cliché. I'm a third generation American kid who yet had the privilege to study with the young people that Semple Sugihara saved. So I'm a cliché. My students today are a cliché, and the truth is they're already a cliché because they're just growing up with Schottenstein. They've never been, you understand, the Gemara, the handling is first the English and then Lashon Kodesh. So the Rav switched to Yiddish, to English. At that moment, it was a death sentence for some of the Rebbeim because ultimately they couldn't keep up with the students. The students laughed at them. The students already were in a different world. How can you have a Rebbe who doesn't speak English, doesn't know baseball, doesn't know the score? But from the visitor, you learn a very important message. You don't stand still. You ride with the waves. And I can tell you what my students have yet to learn about baseball, I still have not forgotten. V'day l'chakima, what you say. So when I walk into class and I cry and mourn that today if you're hitting 215%, 215, you're a hero. Someone hitting 250, what the heck they're paying Rodriguez, he's barely hitting 200. It's beyond words. Ah, but the boys see the Rebbe is in our world. And that I saw in the movie, I saw that from the Rav. You know the famous story with the Rav that I relate, I believe in Washington, in my exercises there on why Gedolei Yisrael love baseball. So there's this, Mo Berlin told me the story when he came in Aliyah, we went to see him in the Merkaz Kital. We already were old timers, we were here about 4 or 5 years when the Berlin, if you know Mo and Raz Berlin, Mo needs a refuah shleima. Our grandchildren are very friendly, went to the same yeshiva, etc. So Mo told me, Arnie, you won't believe it. He lived in Boston. He ran a hospital. Used to daven Mincha Maariv at Maimonides. He said, one time Rebbe says to me, Moshe, be masbir to me what is baseball. Tzivishin Mincha Maariv. So he sits down with the Rav and he starts telling him, you know, first verse, second verse, or home, get the player home, 3 strikes, 4 balls. No, at the end of a half hour, the Rav already is a maven on baseball. If you can master Reb Chaim, baseball is not exactly a shach and a taz. So at the end, he says to him, Rebbe, why is it important for the Rav to know this? And the Rav gives him his benign look. If you knew Rebbe, Rebbe looks at him, Moshe, my grandchildren are coming for Shabbos. It's the Twesky boys. I have to have something to talk with them about. So that's something you learn. Time is fighting me. I wanted to say a few words about Zelig, which is a Woody Allen movie. Woody Allen has to be the biggest idiot alive, and he yet has the right to criticize Israel. But it's an amazing guy, you know, a talent he has, a maneuver to the second, third column, not just a stammer maneuver to I don't want to mention how Mr. Allen is living, and he criticizes Israel. All right, so mizayin gesund. But what's fascinating about Zelig is, I'll tell you a little story out of my teaching years. When I taught for YU in America in the 60s, so my dean was Mr. Norman B. Abrams. You recognize the name, anyone recall? Norm NBA, he used to sign every admit NBA. So one time I had a kid who I saw was psychologically deficient. So Ms. Abrams, so we're having a discussion over some problem students, and I say to Ms. Abrams, I think that this young man would benefit with a little psychological guidance. And Ms. Abrams looks at me and says, Arnold, you were raised without a psychologist, I was raised without a psychologist, and this young student will be raised without a psychologist. That was the attitude. What's fascinating in Zelig, you see how Woody Allen plays Zelig. He real psychological problems, but a psychologist who appreciates him as a human being works very hard to help him turn into a normal human being. And it's a very moving message. A Rebbe, a psychologist, has to be a warmth, a concern. My wife always says to me, you are impossible. You've taught so many students on so many levels. I began, you know, elementary school 59, Talmud Torah, high school, college, postgraduate today for many years already. And she says, and you love every student. I say, you don't understand. I know I have students can be murderers, thieves, but I know that I have some students that are not on the highest level, but I see the soul in every student. Even a person who sins has a soul. You have to know how to reach him. And this is the psychologist there, very impressive. There's one other part to Zelig that is very, very important to me. You talk about leisure time, a little bit of an escape. We live in Israel, and I have to tell you, listen, I'm living here so many years, there was only one day that I can say was a totally happy day. That was July 4th, 1976. Those of us that remember that day, the airport, the coming back, the thousands. Another day, I will admit, there was one night that was Ke'en Olam Haba, and that was the night Yosef HaTzadik Mendelovich, I just met him in the Shuk yesterday, I say to walk around Yerushalayim and you get rewarded. I met Yosef HaTzadik the day he came home. Remember how he wanted to walk to the Kotel from Lod Airport, and they convinced him, Yosef, it's not as close as it looks on a map. And he got off as they approached Yerushalayim, literally right at Givat Shaul, and he started walking. It was about 9 o'clock at night, and the radio was announcing which street he was on. By the time he reached the Kotel, probably was about midnight, there were like 20, 30,000 people there, including myself, my wife, my children. It's a day that you can't forget. But, you know, generally you turn off the radio, you know what's going on, the prime minister, the guy in France. I heard the guy speak today. For a guy who made billions, he can't speak English. Did you hear his English? It was unbelievable. In France, they hate English. It's beyond words. And Shas, what they did say, didn't say. The guy who said it was a kippah twice the size of mine. It's beyond words. They were not going to vote today, but they did vote because it was Lesser Stern's bill. Ugh, we banished a lilim, they gave it. Oh, God, how do we survive? We need a little leisure time. You know what's amazing about Zelig? The photography, they won awards for this, that they're able to play with the computer today. I don't know if you've seen what's going on in the internet. I got today two Talmidim sent to me, the Satmur Ruv sitting, Abinon sitting there, the Satmur Ruv surrounded by his Gabayim, and his wife right next to him, Rebetzin Feiga. They played with a computer, you understand? There's the Satmur Ruv sitting in public with Abinon and there's Feiga. So they played with photography. It's worthwhile seeing Zelig just to see the photography. And the ultimate picture, there is Woody Allen standing next to Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig. And it's right there, black and white, tangible, perfectly, perfectly achieved. Before I end off, I just want to mention one movie that Herb didn't get to because the movie just came out. When I taught high school before Purim, so the water boy, that's what the name of the young man that had to keep water on my desk, so I go to drink, it's vodka. So I taught them a lesson. They're all looking, the whole class was in it, and I didn't react, and all sheer I would. But they didn't realize it was only taking a drop. They said, gee, the Rebbe drinks like an Irishman. I was in the Hollywood, Florida area this winter, and I was speaking to my Talmidim. So Saturday night in one of the big residences there, these gated communities, my dear friend Ivan Gluck says to me, Aaron, come, we're going to show a new movie tonight. How they got the movie? The movie had just come out, the movie called Brooklyn. And there's one scene there that hurts. It would be a perfect movie to recommend. There's one scene, I mean, idiots today. We all know, the Gemara says, Kulam Yodim Lama, everyone knows why a Chatan V'Kala go to Chuppah. So you just show they're closing the door and they're going. But what can I tell you? If not for that scene, it's a fabulous movie. And it's about a Catholic girl from Ireland coming to New York, to Brooklyn. What is it, the early 60s, if I'm not mistaken? And, you know, I lived in a Catholic neighborhood. I know the Catholic world. I know the Irish world, Irish, Italian. I know the differences between them. It's not for now, but I grew up among them. And that movie, Malka and I saw it. It just was a replay of our Aliyah. Exactly before there was a Nefesh ben Nefesh, coming an American in Israel, who was American, who cared about America. All they thought Americans have money and the whole attitude. And who do you talk to? Who are you friendly with? How do you get advice? How do you deal with the banks here? I remember when I told that everyone used to kill each other and they're waiting in the bank, there were no lines. Now I came back, I told the manager, why don't you put ropes in like they have in America and people will wait organized. He said, Zelo yeleichkan. It cannot happen here. Today in my bank, you take a number. There's no one in the bank anyway because it's all by computer. But Baruch Hashem, boy, is that a powerful movie, Brooklyn. I could take every scene there and compare it to 1969 Israel, or the Israeli movie that I love best. They call it today Hashoter, the policeman. We called it originally Azulai Hashoter. Boy, when you see that movie, that is Israel circa 1969. So what have we done so far? We spoke a little bit about movies, Reb Henoch Fishman, Semple Sugihara. There's an endless amount we can learn from movies. We can see ourselves in movies. We can see our children. We can see the very problems that we face, the quests, the desires. And with Torah and learning, we can come out of it on top. But I want to end off. Tell me, this whole talk I gave tonight in a Makom Kadosh in Beit Shemesh, wait a minute, what's going on here? You came in Aliyah, you came to become a total Jew, you become a Baal Teshuva when you come in Aliyah. People ask me why I changed my name. I said, what, are you an idiot? Look, I say this in Washington, look at the Rambam, Hilchot Teshuva, you become a Baal Teshuva, you have to change the name, then open Halachim, the Rambam. You come in Aliyah, you become a total Jew, 100%. What are you talking about? Movies, schmovies, Judy Allen, Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig. So here, let's go back to my classroom. Whenever I taught on a collegiate level, now it's postgraduate, the students are older than me, smarter than me, bigger than me, so I can't start up with them too much. But when I taught on a collegiate level, all right, David, I had many students, and I always insisted on asking them, what's your real name? What name does your girlfriend know you by? So this fellow would say, Ryan. All right? This girl would say, Glenda. And I always insisted on calling them by Glenda, Brian. Some of them, you know, became real Zionists. Fahitzta. How do you say that in English? Fahitzta. All right. Fabrenta. Good. Good. Hey, Rebbe, Zahavit, Glenda went crazy. Zahavit, Zahava. Zahava. I have a granddaughter-in-law who had it, but she was Zahava. Brian, Baruch, what's Brian? And I would tell them, you're lacking the knowledge of a very important Ramban on Chumash. Look into Chumash, HaChodesh Hazel Lachem Rosh Chodashim. And the Ramban asked the fabulous question. Look at our names, Chaldean names. Sivan, Tammuz, some may be names of Chaldean gods. We have beautiful Jewish names, Ziv. Whoever heard use Ziv? We can change it all, it's no big deal. But the Ramban says, You got to remember where you came from. It's very important. The whole Haggadah is based upon Mitachila of Dei Avodah Zarah Hayu Avoteinu. You have to remember where you came from. God doesn't want us to forget our past. When we came on Aliyah, it's not that Sinat Haman. We came from Anglo countries. We lacked nothing there. We were totally at home. We came because of Ahavat Mordechai. We can be very proud that we recall our past and we're happy. We're not sad. We don't claim we have to pass it on to our great-grandchildren. It's not Torah Hashem Tamima. But we who share this heritage, nothing to be ashamed of. Meitachila of Dei Avodah Zarah Hayu Avoteinu. Baruch Hashem, today we are total Jews building a magnificent country and forging the destiny and character of the future of the Am HaTorah, the Jewish people. Thank you very much, Herb. It's your turn.
I'll get into the book, but I first want to begin with a story about the Incredible Shrinking Man. When I was in ninth grade, I went to public school, but
you're talking about Woody Allen.
No, The Incredible Shrinking Man.
Oh, talking about the movie, because you know what I've been trying to do in Woody Allen. That movie, too, he shrinks, he grows fat, small.
I missed that one. In any case, I went to public school, but my rabbi in Mount Vernon encouraged me to go to a religious camp, and I did. And one year he convinced my parents to send me to a yeshiva that was in Manhattan called Heichal HaTorah, run by the London brothers. They were on the forefront of Chinuch, of Kiruv, before Kiruv was even discussed as a profession. So they accepted anybody. And I was one of the anybody's they accepted. So I went there and I met somebody from Wisconsin and we became good friends. And his father came into town one night and wanted to take us out to dinner. So I figured, why not go? So I said, fine. But I realized that when I go for dinner, they're going to ask me where the rabbis in charge of the yeshiva will ask me, where was I? So I happened to look at the paper that day and I saw there was a new movie called The Incredible Shrinking Man. So I said, this is the movie I can see I went to, because if they ask me, I tell them what it's about. It's about a guy who's shrunk. So I went out to dinner, came back, and the rabbi said, I want to talk to you. I said, fine. Where did you go? I went out to the movie tonight, which is somewhat dangerous, because the yeshiva was looking at the outskirts of Harlem, 145th Street and Riverside Drive. So, but I thought, I went to see it, I wanted to see it. He said, fine. What was it about? It was about a guy who's shrunk. Believe it or not, I was sort of, he believed me. And then a few months later, I actually saw the movie, and I said, this is really a kosher movie. Although I didn't think about it in those terms at that point. But I'll get to why it's a kosher movie in a few minutes. But that was, in a sense, the film that made me begin thinking that movies are more than mere entertainment. I want to discuss in about 15, 20 minutes the relationship between the secular and the holy, which I had to deal with as I became more involved with watching movies. I want to tell you a quick story about meeting Rabbi Lichtenstein, who was my Rebbe at YU, meeting him in the elevator and asking him a question about a book I was reading. I want to tell you how I define a kosher movie, and then I'll give you several examples from different genres as I discuss films in the book. Films about parenting, about improving oneself, growing older, adversity, relationships, sports, decision-making. Basically, that's the format of the book. I begin with an anecdote, I then talk about the movie, and then try to pull out a lesson from that particular film. Now, movies were a staple of my growing up in Mount Vernon, New York. My idea of the perfect day, and this is, consider I did not go to a yeshiva, so a perfect day for me was to go to the synagogue in the morning where I participated in what they call junior congregation, and afterwards they had black and white cookies and all good stuff. And in the afternoon, I would go to the movies to watch a double feature. And it transported me to faraway places and to adventures that stimulated my young imagination. It was really, you know, a wonderful opportunity for me, just to begin thinking of life beyond Mount Vernon. But as I got older, and I went to this religious camp, and then I began, you know, my rabbi really invested, you know, my Salman Frail, he lives now in Yerushalayim, he invested a lot of time and energy in me. He invited me over on Friday night, he began to learn with me, and he always encouraged me to go to YU, where they were beginning a Jewish studies program for kids who had not gone to yeshiva before. So I credit him with really being a critical influence on me in my teenage years. And the more I became observant and knowledgeable about Jewish law and tradition, my attendance at movies became suspect because, you know, especially when I started to move among religious people, they weren't as infatuated with movies as I was. And as I continued to watch movies, because I really, you know, saw this as really a great escape, you know, intellectually for me, my taste began to change. I began to look for meaning in films. I wanted them to be not only enjoyable to view, because they should be enjoyable to view, but I wanted to leave the theater enriched with some kind of message. I got something from it. Now, an early favorite of mine was The Defiant Ones. I don't know how you saw it, but it's worthwhile seeing. It starred Tony Curtis and Sidney Poitier. It told the story of two prisoners, one black, one white, and they're on a train. The train crashes, and these two prisoners escape. But there's a problem. They're chained to one another. You know, and they hate one another. But in order to survive, they somehow have to figure out how to get along with one another. And there's a classic scene there. It's raining. They fall into a mud pit. And they're trying to climb out of the pit. And every time one guy reaches up, the other guy pulls him down. It goes nowhere until they finally figure out that the only way they're going to get out of this pit is to work together and somehow survive. So that film, to me, was an important film because I also lived in a city where there's a great separation between blacks and whites. There were two high schools. One was A.B. Davis High School, primarily white, catering to kids who were going to go to college, and then Edison High School, primarily catering to blacks who were interested in vocation. So I was sort of involved in the 50s in a social situation where black and white relations were the topic of a lot of conversation, and this movie, for me, gave me a perspective from which to view this this kind of conflict, which, in many ways, because of watching the film, people began to, you know, have think of blacks and white relationships in different ways. What really, I think, was transformational, when I was at YU, I was in the JSP program, but during my years there, I always heard about Rabbi Yeshiva Soloveitchik and his Yahrzeit Shiurim. I was not in his Shiur. And, you know, as I got more and more, you know, learning under my belt, I felt I wanted to experience what his Shiurim were like. So I went to his Yahrzeit Shiur once. It's hard to find parking. It was so 2,000 people are in Lamport Auditorium. And when he walks in, everybody stands up. I had never heard him before. And I had a note, you know, and my pen ready to go. And I'm listening, and Rabbi Soloveitchik walks in the room, and he starts talking about, it was about the Haggadah, I think, Pesach, and he starts mentioning Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and Shakespeare in the midst of the halakhic discourse. And like, it was mind-opening. The shiur took 3 hours. To me, it felt like 15 minutes. I had never experienced a learning, a lesson like that. It was just, you know, I still have my notes from some guys. I attended a number of Yahrzeit Shiurim. It was just transformational. I just all of a sudden saw an integration of secular and sacred that I had never experienced before. It was just uplifting and exciting, and it just gave me a whole different perspective on things. Now, I was blessed because after that, I entered the Shiur of Rabbi Lichtenstein, was my Rebbe then, and then because of my background, I was in the same class as Rabbi Mordechai Willig, but he was in the front of the row. I used to walk in the class with a big tape recorder and tape every shiur, but it took me, I had to go over the shiur at night just to figure out what was going on when I was there. It was a very major, you know, challenge for me, but I worked at it, and we had a good rapport. I had a good rapport with Rabbi Lichtenstein, and I remember when I was an English major at the time, and I was reading Herzog, the book by Saul Bellow, and I saw him in the elevator, I remember, in first hall, and I said, "Have you ever read this? What do you think of it?" So he looked at me and he said, I don't read anything less than 100 years old. You know, and that'll tell you, I mean, if it's a classic, then I'll spend time looking at it. But it gave me, again, and just a brief elevator on a few seconds, a perspective on literature, that a lot of literature is good, but not everything. I was considering, you know, doing a doctoral thesis on Norman Mailer. And then I asked, at some point, I don't know exactly when, you know, why did he choose to do a doctoral dissertation on Henry Moore, Cambridge Platonist? He's the one, and also he's a Renaissance scholar, because he told me that he connected with men of faith. They didn't have to be Jewish, but he wanted to, he's going to spend that much time, you know, on a secular, you know, pursuit like education, like English literature, at least it should be involved with people who are people of faith, who understand what religion is all about. And then I forgot about Norman Mailer, because I realized that when he's talking about who in another 50 years, they may not even know who he is. And I felt it was important for me to do my research on somebody who was connected to God, and I did the dissertation on George Herbert, who was a 17th century poet who was also a clergyman. So he was an influence on me just in terms of my general thinking, he gave me a point of view from which to view all of literature and all of the arts. It has to be relevant beyond the present moment. It has to reach beyond one's contemporary milieu. And I was in his class, for a year, and I was also with the Kollel when he was the Rosh Kollel, and I began to intellectually and emotionally integrate the secular and the sacred over a number of years. And in his lectures at YU, Rabbi Lichtenstein often expressed the view that there is value in secular culture, and by culture he meant the study of the best that has been thought in the world. He always often quoted Matthew Arnold, the great Victorian poet, who saw literature from the point of view of the touchstones of great literature. If you understand the greatness of Chaucer, Shakespeare, Milton, then they can provide a beacon of light for how you evaluate literature going forward. And if properly approached and balanced, culture can be an ennobling experience, it can be an enriching force even for Torah Jews, because the best of culture, he maintained, offers us through art, through literature, through music, profound expressions of the creative spirit, which is what Rabbi Kevin was talking about, one's individuality, one's ability to be creative and develop his own relationship to God, given the fact that we ought to be in the same framework. Culture gives us the ability to understand our cosmic context. It can help us cope with the human condition and give us a sense of the moral complexity of life. Someone once asked Rabbi Lichtenstein, and this is quoted by many people in other things I've read that memorialized him, what was the most important thing that he learned in graduate school at Harvard? And he said, I learned the complexity of human experience. He understood that life can't be viewed in purely black and white terms. Gray is the common hue to much of human experience. And the great writers of the past, in Matthew Arnold's terminology, enable us to see life steadily and to see it whole. You see the big picture here. So worldly culture has value and can ennoble us, but we have to be able to discriminate between the wheat and the chaff of what we read. And we have to be able to see the difference between the good, the bad, and the ugly, to use a film reference, of what's really worthwhile to spend one's time with in terms of secular culture. Now, the truth is, as you know, there's a lot of websites that deal with how many curse words there are in a film and all the objectionable pieces that you may find in a film. That's not the purpose of the book. My book assumes that once you become a discriminating consumer, there's good stuff. You have to be able to see what's appropriate. Now, you can check if you're interested in a film, and films today basically are corrupting. You know, 95% of them are. You can check a website called IMDb, International Movie Database, and they have a parental guide. They'll tell you exactly why a film has a particular rating, and then you can decide whether you want to subject yourself to that particular film. I have a fairly high tolerance for violence and profanity, but beyond that, I don't recommend films, obviously, but if there's nudity or promiscuity, any terms, I can't call it a kosher film and suggest it. So the films that I recommend in the book basically are films that I think have a message to say, and they may be R-rated, but maybe for violence or profanity. And I say it may not be your cup of tea. On the other hand, you know, there is something to be learned if you're in that world already. I don't encourage people to go to the movies if that's not in your, you know, repertoire of leisure time. But if you go anyway, I can direct you towards films that I think have more value. So let me just mention some of the films that I deal with, and you'll get a sense of what I'm talking about. From the parenting section, I deal with Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And as a school principal, I remember I had a situation where a student had plagiarized on a test, and a parent wanted to meet with me and the teacher. And the meeting began by the parent coming to me and saying to me, "Rabbi Cohn, my son never lies." And I knew the mood was going to go south from that point on. Because even good kids make mistakes. Even good kids lie sometimes. You know, you never know. So, but I saw that, in a sense, the beginning of Ferris Bueller. You know, he tells his parents that he's sick or whatever it is. He makes some excuse why he's not going to school. It's clearly a lie. And his parents just say, "Really? Okay." You know, they take everything he says as truth. It's a naivete that really is destructive. And the point of the film, in a sense, a subtle point of the film, is that parents really have to be aware of what's happening with their kids. And it's more than simply, and the parents rarely spend any face time with them. Ferris Bueller's best friend, who we see throughout the whole film, we never see his father. All we see is the car that his father owns, which ultimately winds up going off a cliff. But the point is that if you want to develop relationships with your children, you need face time. You can't just, you know, delegate and assume that everything's going to be okay. It may not be okay. When I dealt with, in the improving yourself section, I dealt with the film I Am Sam, which is about a person who is mentally, you know, retarded, and he has a child with a homeless woman. We don't even see that. That's the beginning of the film. And then the child is a normal child, and as the child grows up, she's a very smart kid. And then the family services determine that he may not be a fit father because he doesn't have the ability, the knowledge, the skills to parent well. So he's kind of stuck because he loves his daughter. He doesn't want to give her up, but he mentally, you know, is not in a position to insist upon parental control of his child. So it's a heartbreaking film. But what caught me about the film, and I'll focus in these reviews on a particular scene in the film. And at one point, the lawyer who decides on a pro bono basis to help Sam retain his custody rights to his child, she says, "Sam, I don't know how to describe you." She asks Sam, "I don't know what to call you. Retarded, mentally handicapped, mentally disabled, intellectually handicapped, intellectually disabled, developmentally disabled." To which Sam responds, "Just call me Sam." You know, the point is that sometimes when you're dealing with disabilities, I will finish soon. But you sometimes look at the disability and you forget the person about whom you're talking, and that's a big difference. I had a Down syndrome sister, and I remember I used to go with her on Thursday night to a thing called Teen Town in Mount Vernon, and you know, people's conception. I'm moving fast, but. So there was a fellow named Bobby Duffy who played ping pong. And I thought, no, I played Bobby Duffy ping pong. I couldn't even score a point with him. He was so good. Because in a sense, even although I was familiar with Down syndrome, you know, my sister had it, nevertheless, I sometimes viewed kids who had a similar disability as somehow, you know, unable to participate fully in things that I thought that were more normal, and I was totally wrong, because everybody has their own skills, their own approaches, and you never know where it is and where it's at. And you have to really be open and understand that people of all types, even with disabilities, can rise and shine in certain particular ways. A film from the growing older section was, I did two films together, The Hustler and Color of Money. Both starred Paul Newman. One was in the 60s, the pool hall hustler. You know, he goes around trying to make money. He goes to a pool hall. He loses the games deliberately. And then he since everybody knows he's going to lose, they start betting a lot of money. And then when they start betting a lot of money, then he shows how skilled he is. But the point of that film is he's a young man there. And somebody asked him in the movie, you know, why does he admire this particular guy? And he says, and the line really struck with me, and he says, because he has things. In other words, his whole life is just to accumulate material things. He doesn't see beyond that. At the end of the film, it's a tragedy. His whole life falls apart. The Color of Money, directed by Martin Scorsese, takes place like 25 years later. He's a liquor salesman. He has nothing to do with pool. But he sees a very talented pool player in a pool hall, and he says, I can help you. I can make you... And, you know, he wants to relive his youth through this young person, played by Tom Cruise. So he introduces him to the world of hustling, money, through playing pool. And you see, as he gets older and watches this young protege, he says, you know something? I don't want to play pool. I don't want to get the money. I want to just know who's the better player. No, his whole sense of values changes as an older person. He's not interested in the money. He's interested in seeing simply who's best. So that also gives you perspective on aging. When you're younger, you're wrapped up in material stuff, and it just colors the way you see life. When you get older, you have a bigger vision. You see life in much broader terms. And that also is a lesson about how we have to approach our own aging as well. Another film to discuss from the adversity section, Diving Bell and the Butterfly. Amazing film. A person, he in a car crash accident, he gets what we call, it's a true story, I'm an editor of Elle magazine, he gets what we call locked-in syndrome. The accident is catastrophic. He's in a hospital. He can't move any part of his body except his eyelid. That's all. And a nurse who is able to communicate with him decides to help him write about his life. And he actually wrote a book called The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. But the important thing for me, as I watched it, I understood, we don't know what happens tomorrow. Therefore, take every day seriously today, make sure it counts. That's a lesson that's part of many films. But because his disability is so strong, and what's clever about this film, the first 20 minutes of the film, you see things from his perspective. He's narrating. He's trying to get the doctor, a nurse, to come over to him, and nobody hears him. It's a man in crisis. But what he does say, which I thought was really profound, even in face of crisis like this, he can live through in two ways, through his imagination and his memory. And I never thought of that before, that people who are really severely disabled, I don't know how they do it, but somehow they can live by imagining what might be and also by remembering the moments of the past. In his case, it's very sad because he remembers a phone call I should have made the day before to a friend who did me a favor, and he never made the phone call, and now he can't make the phone call. You know, it's a tough movie to watch. Not easy. So I think it's an important lesson there, but it's definitely not for everybody. Another film which I really like was Splendor in the Grass, an old movie with Warren Beatty and Natalie Wood. And I liked it because of the poetry. You know, the Splendor in the Grass is a line from Wordsworth's Ode to Intimations of Immortality. The line essentially says that, after difficulty, even, we will not grieve for the, I ordinarily could quote this easily, but I see the lights going out, so I'm trying to, but we'll grieve not for the past, but rather find strength in what remains behind. This is a story about two people deeply in love with one another. At the end of the day, it doesn't work out. And it occurred to me, what happens when you miss your bashert? You know, you think this is the one, and then it turns out that's not the one. Does life end, or do you simply try and find somebody else, and does life continue? To me, it was an important philosophical point. When you're faced with a situation where what you thought was going to happen doesn't happen, what happened? Do you fold? Do you collapse? Or do you try to figure out a way to keep on going? From the sports section, this is very relevant. I reviewed a film called Facing Ali. What's the whole point? It interviews six fighters who fought Muhammad Ali. This is a movie about 10 years old. The greatest moment in their lives was being in the ring with him, even though they all lost. I thought it was an amazing thing that you want to be close to greatness, even if it doesn't work out. I shared with Merrill, you know, when I decided to enter the rabbinate first, I was asked, do I want to have a shul or be an assistant rabbi? I said, I want to be an assistant rabbi and learn from somebody. So I had the same idea as Rabbi Emanuel Feldman in Atlanta. My point is that to be close to somebody who's really a great person may be better than being on your own, because you have that moment to really learn from a master. And I just thought it was a valuable lesson, which also was echoed in a poem by Milton, you know, when he writes on his blindness, they also serve who only stand and wait. In other words, you don't have to be in the front lines to always make a contribution to the world. You can make a really important contribution on the sidelines or in the shadows. You don't have to be in the front. So that's a lesson that at least I learned from facing Ali. What happened to the six fighters is I mean, it's a tragic story, because, you know, that was the high point of their lives. And their life, after then, they all got encountered other kinds of difficulties. In the decision sections, I comment on one scene in a film called The Untouchables, directed by Brian De Palma. It's about Elliot Ness and Al Capone. There's one moment there which you can where there's an attempt by Elliot Ness to capture the accountant of Al Capone in a train station. And they have to, because Al Capone, that's what they finally caught him for, it was tax evasion. So they go to the train station, and they're about to catch them. And Elliot Ness is a fine family man, sees a lady with a carriage, with a baby, trying to get up the stairs. So he has to catch this bad guy, but he has to help the lady up the stairs. So he goes down there, and then the guy comes off the train, and he has to make a decision. You know, Oseg b'mitzvah, put them in a mitzvah. You know, where do I turn with this? It's a halachic calculus. It's resolved in cinematic terms. It's a very great scene. I don't tell you how it turns out, but it's a fascinating thing to watch, because you see a man really he wants to help the lady, and he has to catch this guy, and he has to make a split decision that is critical to protecting society long term. You can see that clip. It probably is on YouTube. Okay, one more. Rocky, of course, or Les Miserables have a similar theme, the idea of, you know, redemption, tshuva. You know, in Les Miserables, Jean Valjean steals silver candlesticks, and a priest believes him and gives him a chance to redeem himself, whereas everybody else, when they saw him, treated him like a common criminal. So when somebody finally treats you like a mensch, then it changes your whole life. So that's another lesson. And Rocky, the lesson is have a good mentor. You know, understand that sometimes you need help to get through the difficult times. There's a lot of lessons here. I'm just, you know, going very quickly into the time. Castaway, Tom Hanks, guys on a desert island. There, you know, he had that one opportunity in life. He was about to get married to the girl of his dreams. And he says, I'll see you right away. And then his plane crashes. He's lost for 2 years. And his wife marries somebody else as a kid. When he finally is rescued, you know, life is different. So he has to realize how important every moment is, and not to, in a sense, postpone what's really important in life. All the President's Men, I like, because there's a scene there. You know, that's the Nixon business. Watergate. So there's a scene when the two reporters are trying to get information from somebody, but the guy who wants to get it, the guy who says, I'm not going to tell you anything. So I think Carl Bernstein says, listen, I'm going to say this. If you hang up, I'll know it's correct. And if you stay on the phone for 3 seconds more, I'll know it's affirmative. In other words, he tries to to extract information without forcing the other guy to say anything over the phone. Cheval Tyson, yeah. I said to myself, you know, when I give a recommendation, I used to write, you know, when I was a principal, I used to write recommendations for students. So how do you make a mediocre student look good? So again, you try to... What?
He dresses well.
He dresses well. I mean, I can tell you're a professor. Okay, so that's the point. So there's less to talk about. I have another two books ready to write, because movies are always, you know, coming out with new stories. And let me just finish with a comment on The Incredible Shrinking Man. This is a great film. In the 50s, it's a scary film in black and white. The man is on a boat. He's going through a radioactive cloud, although we don't know at the time. And he's on vacation with his wife. And the next scene, we see, you know, my coat, my shirt is a little loose on me, you know.
it's not fitting. Time goes on, he gets smaller and smaller, and it's frightening. And he finally meets a midget in a circus and feels, I finally, you know, can find somebody. And then a few weeks later, he finds himself even sinking swallow. Then the scene opens up next with him in a dollhouse. His wife is very devoted. She's still with him. He's in a dollhouse. And he's in the dollhouse. He's shrinking like this. And the wife goes out of the house, and she leaves the door open. And a cat comes in. The cat walks to the dollhouse. He thinks it's like it's over. So he's fighting for his life, and he falls down into the basement. And he's continuing to shrink. And then he finally wakes up, and he sees at the end of the basement a spider, like a tarantula. And he looks all around. He finds a little, like a pin. And there's a fight to the death with him and this spider. I'll tell you this way. He wins the fight, but he continues to shrink. The last scene of the film, he's at the grating at the bottom of the cell, and he looks up at the sky, and he says, you know something? I reconcile myself. This is what has happened to me. But these are the last words of the film. At least in God's eyes, I exist. I count. And I said to myself, wow, what a Musar Haskell. No matter what happens, my relationship with God is still there. That's still able to survive. No matter what happens in my life, I still have that connection. So I'll take any questions and answers, or I'll like any questions, perhaps I might give an answer. But that's basically what the book is about. If you have any other thoughts, please share them with me. By the way, I have a blog. I write the reviews. I write occasionally for the Huffington Post. I'm writing now blogs for the Times of Israel. And I write my own blog, and if you want to get the reviews, you can either friend me on Facebook, or you can, I have cards out in the hall, you can just take it's koshermovies.com. I have more to talk about, but it's getting late. Yes, Daniel. It was a famous joke. Somebody asked me once, it's not my joke, are you a man of decision? And the guy answered, well, yes or no. So I answer your question the same. Some have that deliberate intention, some don't. But what's critical is that the movie first has to be entertaining. If it's only a lesson, then nobody's going to go see it. It's irrelevant. But I try to find, you know, something good in the film, if I can. Sometimes I can't, and then I won't write about it. I don't write about every film I've seen. Some I just feel is that, you know, the crosses the line, or it's so vacuous, I can't say anything. So sometimes they do. Other questions? Yeah. Yes?
Do you ever write about Israeli films?
The truth is, I don't. I'm going to write probably about Ushpizin, which I think is an extraordinary film. But I don't do that because in my own mind, you know, coming to Israel, I always felt Israel is the home of Torah. You know, I don't see Israel as, even though they did produce some good movies, I don't have any real interest in seeing Israeli films, because when I think of Israel, I think of Torah and the spirituality. You know, America is the land of Gashmias and movie making, and I can relate to it there. That's why almost all my films have nothing to do with Judaism. I'm not looking for that. I want to find a film that is an entertaining film that has something to say. Any other questions? Thank you all for coming. Yes, it's true. Let's go. Thank you.
You want to let me say a few words if anyone listening and why you, how they can get the book?
Answer that. Okay.
If somebody would like to get the book Kosher Movies, it's available through Amazon. And when I come to the States, I'll autograph it for you.